The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to introduce our guests. An assistant professor of education at Columbia University's Barnard College, Erica M. Kitzmiller has conducted research in the city of Philadelphia, its public schools, and the Free Library of Philadelphia for nearly two decades. The result of her investigation is her new book, The Roots of Educational Inequality, a decades-spanning report of the factors contributing to one school's path from first-rate institution to its 2014 closure. Kitzmiller's writing has appeared at the Harvard Educational Review, Dissent, and the Philadelphia Inquirer, among other publications. And her work has received funding from the National Academy of Education, the National Science Foundation, and the Russell Sage Foundation. Tonight, Ms. Kitzmiller will be in conversation with Ted Domers, School District of Philadelphia, Assistant Superintendent and former Germantown High School teacher, Janelle Moore Almond, School District of Philadelphia graduate and a teacher at Carver High School, and Akira Drake Rodriguez, an assistant professor at the Weitzman School of Design at the University of Pennsylvania. It's great to have you all with us. Erica, the screen is yours.
Thanks, Andy. First, I just want to thank Andy for arranging this event. I want to thank my publicist, Gigi Lamb at Penn Press, for all of her help making this possible. I would also like to thank Akira, Janelle, and Ted for giving up part of your Thursday evening when the world is on fire to be with us and comment on this book. I also want to really thank the librarians and staff at the Free Library of Philadelphia, who for many years pulled books, sources, documents from stacks, attics, basements, I don't even know where sometimes, and made much of this book possible. I could not have done this without your support, the librarians in the Government Documents Office, the History Department, the Education Department, and the branch libraries make the city of Philadelphia a place that I still love and hold dear to my heart. As many of you probably know, at the turn of the 20th century, Germantown, a community in Philadelphia's northwest corner, was home to a diverse group of individuals, but mainly wealthy white residents who preferred the city's suburban periphery to its chaotic core. While Germantown's bourgeois residents beamed with pride about their isolated community, they were deeply concerned about their children, particularly their native white daughters, traveling to and from the city's limited set of high schools located in the city's bustling inner core. Beginning in 1907, Germantown residents waged a successful seven-year campaign to build a majestic neighborhood high school tucked neatly away in their quaint, secluded community. When Germantown High School opened in 1915, the school offered a first-rate academic curriculum with coursework in Latin, Greek, botany, and rhetoric. Students were taught by teachers that were experts in their field, such as Dr. Ann Mulliken, the first woman to receive a doctorate in mathematics from the University of Pennsylvania. And after graduation, Germantown students enrolled in the nation's leading colleges and universities. Young men like Forrest W. Brainerd went to Columbia, Harvard, and Haverford, while young women such as Barbara Manley went to Barnard, Wellesley, and Smith. Eventually, they assumed roles as leaders in Philadelphia's business and civic life. At the turn of the 20th century, Germantown High School was regarded as one of the leading secondary schools in the nation. Residents believed that it provided its graduates with a first-rate academic education and the necessary credentials to secure a prosperous future. Almost a century later, Germantown High School was once again featured in newspaper headlines. However, unlike earlier coverage that had celebrated the school's academic progress, this news signaled the school's demise. On December 13, 2012, William Height, the superintendent of the School District of Philadelphia, announced that Germantown High School was one of 37 schools slated for closure due to enrollment decreases, low achievement, and a district-wide fiscal crisis. According to Height's report, the school district's crisis stemmed from decades of flight from the public school system, district mismanagement, and inadequate public aid. In response, Philadelphians took to the streets to denounce state officials who had slashed millions of dollars in educational aid and the proposed school closures. Principals begged their families to donate hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to make up for the funding losses. And Philadelphia families did what they could. They opened their checkbooks and wallets and donated their own money to guarantee that their children's public schools had basic essential resources. This approach only worked in the schools that served the city's most advantaged children. Principals in the city's poorest public schools had to find a way to cope with grossly inadequate public aid. For months, Germantown High School administrators, teachers, and alumni collaborated with elected officials and community members to find a way to keep their nearly 100-year-old school building open. They hosted rallies, attended community-wide discussions, and proposed alternatives. But school officials ultimately voted to close the school. And on June 21st, 2013, teachers packed their classrooms, moved their belongings, and shut the doors to Germantown High School. By the time Germantown closed, I had been working in the school and community for nearly a decade, first as a volunteer and then an ethnographer, and eventually as a historian. This book is the product of my long quest to understand the school's place in its community and city, which involved combing through institutional and personal archives, connecting with people, listening to stories, and protesting its educational injustice and inequity in the city that I loved dearly and once called home. The book rests on the shoulders of many people, educational advocates, educators, librarians, archivists, families, and youth, who share their perspectives, open their doors, and taught me so much along the way. I am so grateful to them. The Roots of Educational Inequality explores the political, economic, and social factors that transformed American high schools and contributed to the broader escalation of social inequality in America over the past 100 years. This study deepens our understanding of urban school inequality by pushing the story further into the past to show how the interactions of race, space, and resources help account for the ways that demographic change, white flight, and white resistance transformed the American high school, and in this case, ultimately led to the closing of Germantown High. Despite the wealth of scholarship on urban communities and schools, this is the first book to trace the history of one high school in the context of its community and city over the entire 20th century, deploying a longitudinal analysis that investigates daily events rather than focusing on solely on key turning points. The approach shows that Philadelphia's 21st century crisis stemmed from choices that leaders made over the course of the school's 100-year history, beginning, of course, with its founding. The challenges of racial segregation, fiscal instability, and philanthropic subsidies are not the simple byproducts of white flight, failed desegregation, and neoliberal reforms. These structural inequalities have existed since American public schools were founded at the turn of the 20th century. And there were always alternatives, other paths that we might have taken to create a more just and equitable system of schools. And as this story shows, sometimes individuals did that, and sometimes they did not. While the Roots of Educational Inequality acknowledges the role of post-war residential and economic flight, it insists that public schools never had the sufficient public resources to operate effectively. Rather than raise taxes to the levels required to fund city schools, urban school districts instead relied on philanthropy to subsidize inadequate government aid. And while this philanthropy provided essential supports to urban public schools, the dependency on private funds generated spatial inequities based on race and class, and often masked the inability of urban school districts to fund their schools with public revenues. This masking, of course, was much more likely to occur in bourgeois white enclaves like Germantown, where upper and middle class residents could afford to supplement inadequate public school budgets with their own private funds. While many scholars have examined the connections between philanthropy and education, none of these works illustrate how local philanthropy created what I called doubly advantaged schools. These schools, which are majority white and majority wealthy, were doubly advantaged because they could rely on philanthropy to supplement inadequate public aid, and because their student bodies had more social and financial capital than most others in the city. As the story shows, the location of these doubly advantaged schools changed as the spatial patterns of class and race changed over time. At the turn of the 20th century, Germantown High School was a doubly advantaged school, but by the turn of the 21st century, it was not. This book focuses on three central themes: the social organization of education and the construction of urban and metropolitan space, the political economy of urban education, and the failures of educational policy. The first theme illustrates how the American metropolis shaped and was shaped by its system of public schools. Since the founding of Germantown High School in 1915, school officials have supported an unequal system of schools that has privileged white and middle-class communities and disadvantages Black and low-income communities. As the map from this book shows, the policies and decisions that officials made about school construction, catchment areas, and resource allocations have intensified racial segregation and educational inequality. Oftentimes, these policies correspond neatly with existing patterns of race and class segregation in the metropolis and its schools. For example, as the map shows, at the turn of the 20th century, Philadelphia school officials built the majority of its new modern elementary and high schools in majority white communities and neighborhoods on the city's periphery, in places like Germantown and West Philadelphia, while poor immigrant and Black youth attended substandard antiquated schools in the city's center. School district policies and practices reinforced and intensified patterns of class and race-based segregation in the metropolis and its schools, School officials caved to resident demands to build new modern high schools, such as Germantown High School in the city's periphery, to retain and attract white middle-class families to the city's bourgeois enclaves. These policies privileged children of the upper and middle-class white families who moved from the city center to its periphery and then out to its racially segregated suburbs. The book's second theme centers around the political economy of urban education. In this book, political economy refers to the ways that public policy and government regulation shape the economic, political, and social welfare of American youth and their families. This happened in at least two ways. First, the policy decisions that government and school officials made about school construction, curricular programs, and resource allocations influenced the reputation of individual high schools. High schools with newer buildings, academic programs, and higher per pupil expenditures were perceived as better, more desirable institutions. As the racial demographics of Philadelphia's public schools shifted and white middle-class families moved first to the city's periphery and then to its suburbs, the reputation of Philadelphia's high schools shifted as well. As schools became more bourgeois and white, the schools' reputations improved, and as schools had more poor and Black students, their reputations declined. In other words, the reputation of the school often corresponded with the race and class composition of the students inside the building. In the past, like today, a school's reputation influences the decision that upper middle class families, those families that actually had and still have the social and financial capital to exercise choice, made about their homes and schools. These decisions ultimately affected the racial composition and eventually the intensification of racial segregation in Philadelphia's public schools. The chain reaction of district level policies, demographic shifts, and individual choices shaped the reputation of Philadelphia's high schools and the demographics of the student who enrolled in them. School funding policies and practices also influence the political economy of urban education. Scholarship that attributes the demise of urban education to a decline in school funding argues that there was a golden age of education at the turn of the 20th century, when public officials and civic leaders used public dollars to fully fund urban high schools. According to these scholars, as white flight occurred, the tax revenues that once supported a robust system of urban public schools vanished. This book directly challenges this view. It argues that urban schools were never funded adequately, and since the beginning of the 20th century, urban school districts have lacked the tax revenues needed to operate their schools. Rather than raising taxes, urban school districts such as Philadelphia, Detroit, and Cleveland instead relied on private philanthropy to subsidize insufficient government aid. The dependence on philanthropy intensified educational inequality between and inside the city's public schools. Upper and middle-class white families, such as those in Germantown's bourgeois enclave, supported their children's schools through private philanthropic efforts. Schools in these communities were able to offer first-rate education because the upper and middle-class white families supplemented grossly inadequate public budgets with their own funds. School administrators then used these funds to purchase textbooks, modernize classrooms, and support extracurricular programs. The philanthropic efforts extended beyond the schoolhouse. Bourgeois families also donated time and money to a dense network of recreational clubs, philanthropic organizations, and social service agencies that provided an array of privately funded health and recreational activities outside of the school, such as the Wissahickon Boys Club, shown here in this picture. The spatial patterning of race and class, first by neighborhoods within the city, and then between the city and its surrounding suburbs, benefited white and upper middle class youth by giving them access to educational resources that were largely unavailable to poor and Black youth, because their families lived in different neighborhoods and lacked the private resources to compensate for shortfalls in urban school budgets. Finally, the book focuses on the failures of educational policy to translate ideas and recommendations into school reforms that might create more just and equitable educational outcomes for all youth. For decades, educational reformers have tried to put policies in place to match high school curricula to labor market needs and students' vocational aims. As this story illustrates, Germantown High School, at least initially, was immune from these reforms, because it was largely a white upper middle class institution with a mission to prepare its graduates for post-secondary schooling and futures as middle class professionals and wives. From the school's founding, Germantown High School faculty routinely encouraged Black youth to enroll in the school's commercial and vocational programs rather than its prestigious academic program. For decades, Black youth, such as Adrienne Morrison, was the only Black student in the school's 1950 National Honor Society. She defied this advice. Statistical analysis of graduate data shows that from 1920 to 1950, contrary to conventional wisdom, Black youth were significantly more likely to enroll in Germantown's academic program than white youth. The Black youth who graduated from Germantown High School in the first half of the 20th century understood the racial discrimination that their families faced on the labor market. And they knew that the only avenue for social mobility was an academic diploma. And thus, if they attended high school, they fought to obtain an academic degree to avoid manual work and assume a professional position as a Black doctor, lawyer, or teacher. This project leverages an interdisciplinary approach to scholarship that uses an array of quantitative and qualitative methodologies from education, history, sociology, and a diverse source base. I examine graduate demographic data gathered from school yearbooks, shown here in this slide, as well as the census shown here in this slide, to understand how students' class, race, gender, and ethnicity of the Germantown student body changed over time. Using quantitative methods and data for thousands of Philadelphia youth, I've analyzed these demographics to understand how race and class influence students' educational opportunities and labor market outcomes. I use geographic information system software shown here in this slide to map this quantitative data to show the spatial distribution of the community's youth by race and ethnicity. I leverage qualitative and historical methods, examining city and community newspapers, such as this hand-scripted meeting notes from the Germantown and Chestnut Hill Improvement Association, political scrapbooks, the Philadelphia Board of Educational Annual Reports, which are held at the Free Library of Philadelphia. These sources let me connect the political, economic, and social forces that shape the history of the school and its community to larger historical changes. I also use Germantown High School yearbooks, newspapers, and newsletters to document historical changes inside the high school to understand the perspectives that youth brought to these changes. I use ethnographic methods as well, filming oral history interviews with Germantown High School alums, teachers, advocates, and I conducted participant observations at school events and rallies. These interviews and observations allowed me to analyze how school district and school divisions affected the lives of adolescent youth and how their experiences inside the school were shaped by the intersections of class, gender, and race. The roots of educational inequality shows how class, race, space, and resources have intersected with the political economy of urban education to create unequally resourced schools within one urban school district. It argues that our high schools are not actually broken, but they are actually operating as they were designed to. These institutions were founded to provide different opportunities and resources to Black and white children, to rich and poor children. And these differences can be traced to the fiscal policies that existed at the turn of the 20th century. We can only see that by examining the history of one institution from its founding to its closure, and this is the first book to do this. The story that follows, which focuses on one city, one school district, and one high school, sheds light on the broader transformations of urban school communities and schools across America, on the ways that our nation has failed to provide Black schools and poor schools with equal and adequate resources, and the possible solutions to address their shortcomings in the hope of creating more equitable and just outcomes for all youth today. Thank you.
Thank you, Erica. I know we're going to segue a little bit into doing some questions, and I'm going to kick that off, but definitely feel free to drop questions into the Q&A. Erica, I wanted to kind of, you did like a really good job of kind of like laying out your methods and the archive. Could you talk a little bit more about what went into that sort of archival search, what resources you found, what resources maybe you contributed to, and sort of how we can continue to learn more about this fantastic history of Germantown High?
Yeah, I would say that I did a lot of digging and a lot of talking and a lot of listening. I started at the Germantown Historical Society, and I started at the Free Library by looking at sources from 1907 to 1913. I conducted oral histories with advocates and alums because I think it's really important to listen to the stories of people's experiences, both in the community and inside the schools, things that aren't necessarily found in archives. And I was really lucky that I worked with fantastic Germantown High School teachers who let me work with Germantown High School youth who were equally fantastic and amazing, who asked really good questions about the yearbooks that we looked at and asked really good questions when they supported my work on the oral history interviews. And I'm fortunate that at Barnard, I have some students who are helping me create an online repository of that. And so you can look at that on my website with guiding questions and archival documents that are available for the public to look at and use as they read the book.
Another question that I was going to, I didn't tell you that I was going to ask you this, but I'm kind of intrigued on it. Outside of kind of like, you were at Germantown, so it lent itself to you. Why Germantown? You know, like, how does this compare to other high schools, either in Philly or across the nation? Just kind of classic exams question right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get this question a lot. It's an interesting one. I decided to study Germantown because it's a typical high school. And I think that's really important. It's a high school that is a neighborhood high school that didn't have like a special leader. It didn't have a special admissions policy. And I wanted to think about what the challenges that it faced in the 21st century were if I was to look backward. So a lot of people when I was there would tell me about what a fantastic school it used to be. And as I write in my prologue, I had some doubts about that as my parents shared their own not so fantastical experiences going to comprehensive neighborhood high schools. And so I think like thinking about wondering, was it so fantastic for everyone? And what did that mean was really important to me. I did not anticipate studying this through a historical lens when I first went there. I thought I was going to write a book about an amazing leader, and Germantown had an amazing leader the year I was there. But I did not use that work in this book, right? Because I wanted to think really backwards. And I thought as an educator, that was the responsible thing to do. And so that's why I picked Germantown. I think it's important for historians to look at schools that are not outliers. I think it's really important to think about what are the kinds of schools that most kids go to and in the United States of America, and what are the histories of those places. And I was lucky to Germantown as a place that has a long and documented history. Tom Segrew once said it might be the most well-documented four blocks in America. So I have a lot of Germantown residents to thank for that. And also a lot of alums who, you know, I talked to one person and then I talked to four and then I talked to eight and then I talked to 12. And so to think about the commitment of educators and youth and families and residents of the Germantown area to that history and helping me do it is really important to me.
Awesome. I'm going to hand it off to Janelle.
Thank you so much, Kira. So before I ask the question, I just want to preface this with the fact that as I was reading the book as a Philadelphian, as a graduate of Philadelphia Public Schools, there was so much of my life and my family's life that sort of traced the chapters. So I was telling Erica, like, my mother graduated from Germantown in 1968, including all of my relatives of her generation. When they talked about like school desegregation, like that was my era under Connie Clayton. My younger brother graduated from Lincoln on Motivation, which is also talked about in the book as well, and still exists as a school. So as someone who was born and raised in Philly, it was fascinating to see this bigger story and this context layered on sort of my own educational and my family's educational journey. So I really, really appreciated that. So my first question goes back to the beginning of Germantown and how part of the reason Germantown was opened was in response to a very specific racially coded, gendered narrative about protecting young white women, right? My question to you is, what are some of the other narratives that are either racial or gendered that exist today that influence and impact how schools are funded and also how schools, how parents and communities choose to support or not support schools?
Yeah, that's a hard question, Janelle. Not that you're-
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I mean, there's just so many, right? I mean, Ted and I were talking earlier about this very question, right? To think about the racialized and gendered aspects of the founding of the school. I think like the commentary about white men aren't going to college is both racialized and gendered, right? In terms of from COVID-19, the anxieties around that and thinking about no one had anxieties about white men not going to high school in 1907 because they could get jobs very easily because of their whiteness and their networks, right? And so to also like part of what I really want to think about is what is the purpose of education for whom and what kind of education are we offering to families and kids, right? And so when I looked at Simon Gratz's curriculum in the 1930s and 40s, as the school becomes increasingly Black, the curriculum shifts to become increasingly vocational. So we can see the home economics track, which was to prepare women to get PhDs at places like Bryn Mawr and Barnard and Wellesley. Well, you can't get PhDs there, but they were getting PhDs at Bryn Mawr for sure in things like chemistry, and they were making sure that our food was safe to eat, right? They were not domestic servants. So like, again, thinking, what does that mean? Even the manual labor course at Germantown, when you look at the yearbooks, those kids were not becoming, you know, apprentices in carpentry shops or in factories. They were going to MIT and Penn State. And so again, they were becoming engineers. And so to think about the erosion of vocational work as a post-secondary preparation, at Germantown, when you took the manual labor course in 1920, you were going to get into MIT, Lehigh, or Penn State's like engineering program. And when you did the domestic science program, which was tiny, you were going to be one of the first women to get a PhD in chemistry or economics. when that became introduced at Gratz, you were going to become a domestic servant. So again, like the intersections of race and gender around curricular decisions, and then thinking about the resources, so that the resources in those programs at Germantown were deeply funded with chemistry laboratories for the home economics students, whereas the home economics students at Gratz were learning how to mend clothing, right? So again, like we can call it the same thing, but until you look inside the school, you can't really see what that actually looks like. And I think that's one of the hardest things for historians to really grapple with, is if you can't really imagine what that's like by listening to what people are telling you, you can't really make any claims on what that is. If I just looked at it at face value, and so many historians would say to me, well, it was home economics at Germantown. And I had to be like, well, let's look at the yearbook and what did those folks do in the 1930 census. And so I think thinking around that, but also the ways in which we think about how gender is normed in schools, right? I mean, you think about this every day, Janelle, in your classroom. I know that for sure. But thinking about the ways in which children are acculturated to gender norms, to gender binaries, which are harmful. And we can think about what's going on in the state of Texas right now is completely harmful around making sure children can live their most authentic and truest visible life. Like that is one of the best things that we've done. And that's under huge threat, and their lives are under huge threat in terms of trans students who live in the state of Texas and many other states, right? So I think those things are really important, thinking about how gender norms, I mean, there was a gate in the middle of Germantown High School to physically divide women and men from one another. And so that iron gate came down in the Depression because suddenly boys had to go to school because they couldn't find jobs. So again, was that really equity? No, that was just practicality. Like we had to make room for the boys. So I think that those are really important questions to think about. And I think also thinking as you just posed in the question, the intersections between gender and race and not disentangling those, because that first chapter is so clear that gender and race were part and parcel of this package to get this high school, and that the high school is literally being created to protect white native born women from falling in love with the wrong person. So sexuality is also part and parcel of like what that means. Don't get on the trolleys because you might meet my grandfather, who's an Italian immigrant, who's not the person you're supposed to marry if you're a white native born bourgeois Germantown or Chestnut Hill or Mount Airy person. And those three communities were all considered Germantown in 1910, which is also hard for folks in Philly to imagine sometimes. So yeah, I think it's clear as day. And I think also thinking about how these high schools were founded, I think that gender and race plays a huge intersectional component to why high schools existed the way they did in the early 20th century, and something that we've ignored for far too long.
Can I ask another one?
Yeah.
Okay. So my second question is actually because one of my students is in the audience. Hey, Samir. What you provide is very much a global view of policy, of culture, of financial decisions. But on the ground, for those of us who are in classrooms every day with students that don't get the same resources, who may not be doubly advantaged, to use the language from your text, what does this mean for them? What does this book mean for students right now?
I think it means two things. I'm going to answer something about what it means for educators, and then I'm going to answer the student question, because I think both are really important. One of the things that I kept coming back to every single time when someone would tell me their experiences is how much an educator can make a difference, both either opening doors or closing them for students. Like I just, every single time someone would share a story, particularly someone from a poor background or someone who was Black, right? It would be clear that if they went to college, or if they played football, or if they joined a club or activity, it was largely because of their families, but oftentimes it was also because of an educator who opened a door for them. In the case of Ernie Cuff, it was because an educator closed a door for them, right? And so to think about like, what does that mean for kids? I think also, I'm gonna steal something that my Barnard students told me. In terms of thinking about for youth. I showed my students at Barnard a clip of Savannah Holman and Marion Campbell's oral history interview, which is a 2-minute clip that's on my website. There were 9 Black students in Germantown's 1936 class. And that those 9 Black students in that 1936 class basically protested the DC trip because they could not stay in a hotel in Washington, DC because of racial segregation. And when they fought their advisor about this, the advisor simply said, well, you just have to find a private home. Marion Campbell, who I interviewed, you know, in her 80s, she said, as if it had been yesterday, she said, what private home could I stay at in Washington, D.C.? Who did I know in Washington, D.C.? Those 9 students protested the racial segregation of Washington, D.C. and the school's decision to force students to go on a trip to a segregated city where they could not stay in the hotel that all the white students were staying at. And those students got the trip canceled. And my Barnard student said, you know, there are 9 students. And by speaking up about an injustice in their own school, they shut down the trip. Now, they didn't acknowledge the racism, but they did shut down the trip. And that was a moment of pride for both Marion and Savannah in their interview so many years later. And I just, when my students pointed that out, I just thought, like, they're right. It was nine kids in a class of probably 300 who bravely stood up to the racism that they were experiencing inside their school. And they made a change that maybe we don't remember today, other than the fact that they told us this, but they made a change for the other 7 kids in their class. And hopefully they made a change for some of those white students who heard their Black friends protesting injustice in their school. And I think really deeply about that. Not that I want kids to be on the front lines. I wish schools were equitable and just, but I think when kids speak up and out and they advocate for one another, really remarkable things can happen, even in schools that are not equitable and just. So that's what I would say, but it helps when we got teachers like you helping them out to Janelle. So I would say that too, like, right, if we can have educators and youth working together and really letting the youth lead the way with the support and love and nurturing of educators, like, the world is unstoppable, really, is what I believe. I am an optimist, even though this book may not make people think that way.
Thank you so much. Ted, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Janelle, always very, very hard to follow, Janelle. I wanted to just share my 2 quick pieces. I'd be remiss if I didn't share my Germantown hoodie that I brought with me tonight. And I remember very vividly the Frank Bird incident that's opened at the start of the book, happening down the hall for me and speaking with students and experiencing that. But the memory that most sticks with me that I was thinking about in preparing and in a way sort of bookends what you just shared, Erica, too, is my first year at the school when I was teaching there, we took a trip to Plays and Players on Delancey Street to see a play with the students and the bus never showed up to pick us up. And so I was stranded in the city in Center City with 33 students, and I didn't know how to navigate SEPTA to get back to the school. And I had to rely on the kids to get me back to the school. So we took the Broad Street line up to the XH and then went up. And I'll never forget the way the kids, sort of the way the power dynamic totally shifted as they knew I was totally powerless in the situation. And I remember they literally huddled and stood around me. And it was a really powerful moment for me personally, professionally, especially as a young white teacher who was not from the city of Philadelphia, and the way that I connected and the way that just challenged what people thought of Germantown students. And so what I so appreciate about your book, Erica, and what we talk so much about is the way that the way you take the history, as you said, you look inside the school and apply that to what's happening now. And so I wanted to ask you 2 questions about sort of what's happening today and how we can learn from the 100 years of Germantown High School and think about it today. So the first one I wanted to talk about was sort of thinking about academic programming, school design, and really using what you and Janelle, building on what you and Janelle were just talking about, of sort of looking at this race and genderized piece to it and thinking about, you know, the 8 academic programs in the 60s to the SLCs of the 90s to the Lankinall program and then to the Promise Academy in 2010 and the impact of NCLB, and thinking about what you learned about the school and how that influences us now around school programming, school design, and specifically ways that we can benefit our most marginalized youth.
Yeah, I think it's at the end of the book where I talked to Germantown teachers about what the school district could have done differently to support them. And one of the teachers just clearly says, more money without so much strings attached to it, right? So all of those reforms that you just listed, right, all have strings attached to them in terms of like dictating like how teachers have to spend the money and how principals have to allocate the funds. And that doesn't really allow for creative, autonomous, free teaching and learning, right? I mean, I remember when I was at Germantown High School and the school got a Department of Labor grant, and one of the teachers couldn't even buy digital cameras for her to go outside in the community and document the racial demographic shifts that had happened over time. She wanted the students to go to the Historical Society and look at old historical photographs. And she wanted the kids to go around their community and take photographs of where they lived and learned. That wasn't allowed per the Department of Labor. And so I think a lot about teachers know what's best for their students. And oftentimes they just don't have the resources to do that. NCLB is case in point, right? Teacher evaluations. There's just a recent study that showed all of this money spent on evaluating teachers didn't really produce any results. So instead of spending money on evaluating teachers or scripted curriculum that forces teachers to do things that they know are not beneficial to children, we should just trust teachers who do the right thing every day in Philadelphia public schools all the time. I see it all the time. I'm very lucky. I saw it at Germantown High School, even the year after many people said you wouldn't see that. I mean, I was there the year after Ted was there, and I heard about this guy, Ted Domers, who did these great things. I saw Shirley Archie doing amazing things. Dave Baker, so many Philadelphia public school teachers who, with the barest resources imaginable, loved, nurtured, and cared and taught children, and children taught one another. And so that was, I think, why I couldn't write about the one-year miracle, because it wasn't a one-year miracle. It was a long, neglect. Deb Grill says it, and I can name Deb because she said it, she often felt like Germantown was the stepchild of the school district. Teachers felt like the school was going to close because it had been starved of resources for the entire decade that I was there. And I watched it happen. And so no one was surprised that it closed. I think they were surprised that people just never really trusted them to do the right thing. The SLCs were working and then they stopped, and they could have continued under different arrangements, right? There's so many times where things were improving and working, and then suddenly a new regime came in and a new reform. Connie Clayton's desegregation program was working. And then the state decided to cut funding, right? I mean, she has no control over that. So I think those are the really important things to think about. And I think also one thing that I've been learning with people that I'm doing this online book club is Philadelphia has never had the autonomy to make the best decisions for its schools. And so that's a real question. If you can't allocate resources and raise taxes because the state is in charge of who you are, that's a real problem. And that's not true in most school districts. That's certainly not true in most suburban school districts that are on the periphery of the city. And so to think about the limitations that has for teachers and administrators inside schools, as I said, it's an impossible situation many times in this book for people.
I mean, that resource of love and care as a first year teacher, I remember being so stunned that Dave Baker's classroom, which was down the hall from me, was literally never empty. And I couldn't figure out why this guy never wanted a lunch or any time to himself, which I so desperately needed as a first year teacher. And just so admiring the fact that he was playing mute. I mean, just the love and care that came out of that class. And building upon this funding piece.
And so many others. Dave Baker's just one example.
And Dave was just down the hall for me. So it's such a mentor, and Deb and so many others. Thank you. It wasn't to disqualify anyone else. But the dually advantaged piece. And you talked about the strings attached on the Department of Labor with NCLB and others, and also the private funding and the strings attached that come with that. And how, I guess what I'm asking is, how do we reconcile that? How do we create a system where private funding can exist in schools? And how do we create a system that's built on equity and allows philanthropy to exist in schools without it overtaking or becoming something where, this dually advantaged system, and it becomes the haves and the have nots in that way?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to admit that it happens. So that would be step one. I think one of the things that's so interesting is most schools don't actually acknowledge the private funding that they are actually getting, right? So that's not even an acknowledgement. It's as if students are just have more resources, but they're not really acknowledging where it comes from. So I think that's number one. Number two, I think, and this comes from my own work as a teacher in Wayland, Massachusetts. In Wayland, Massachusetts, we had a public schools foundation. But in Wayland, Massachusetts, we also required that if you donated to my school, you had to match the dollars to Akira School, Janelle School, and Ted School, right? And so you couldn't then create a situation in which one school became the have school and then the other two school became the have not school. And that school district was a suburban school district. It's very well resourced, but there were still class inequities and racial inequities within that district. And so I think that that's an easy solution, right? We could have it that if you're going to donate to your kid's school, you have to match those dollars for a school district fund, or the schools that have friends of groups could adopt another school and they would then match the dollars for that school. I mean, I'm not saying that's perfect. I don't think we're going to get rid of private funding for public education. People love to donate to their public schools. I don't think that's going away. I do think, though, that people should think about when they're donating to their public schools, what else can they also be donating to? So if you're going to donate to your public school, can you also think about the things in your city which serve the entire city, like libraries, like food banks, like other social service programs like the Boys and Girls Club, right? To think about, can you as a citizen of a city and not just advantaging your own child, think about how you can use your resources and dollars to make more equity available to everyone in the city. And also when you go and vote, vote for school resources. Like, and I don't mean that flippantly, but like, think about everyone's children. Think about every child in your city when you are advocating for the city. And I'm not saying I do that perfectly, but I sure do try to think about not just my own two children who have massive privileges because of who I am, where I work, where I was educated, who my family is, a million things, my race, my gender. I mean, I could go on, but to think about not just my children, but everyone's children, and to think about the policies and practices that we want to see put into place to make sure that we are creating a city that is equitable and just for everyone and not just our own backyard. I think that's really important in terms of voting. Okay, I'm going to try to tackle this Q&A. Let's see. Let me start from the bottom. Whoa, there's so many questions. Okay, I promise that I will try to answer as many questions as I can in the limited time we have, but I was not expecting this many. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to answer this question about dominant urban education narratives. We continue to hear from leaders, corporate districts, city, that city districts need to make specific investments in specific neighborhoods and programs, for example, GNT magnet schools, to keep middle-class parents in cities, districts to be able to maintain a tax base to support economically and disadvantaged communities. Can you talk about how this is a kind of rationale continues to privilege certain voices in educational policy and spending? This question is from Heidi. I mean, I think in the book, that's the narrative, right? Is that when white flight begins to happen and it begins way before the post-war period, you can see Germantowners advocating in 1909 that if the school district of Philadelphia does not, and city officials do not give them a high school, George Darrow says in 1909, we will just move to the suburbs. So they're already threatening with their whiteness to demand things that they feel like they're privileged to be able to get. That is the history of public education in the city of Philadelphia, like most places. So I don't think that that's necessarily something new. I think we can see that in daily reporting. We can see that in New York City in terms of how people think that GNT programs should be allocated, where they're allocated, how many students from the Bronx are at Stuyvesant High School, not very many, right? How many Black students are at Stuyvesant High School? Again, single digits most years. So to think about the ways in which those programs are not available to the whole city. We have solutions that we could be putting into place to make that happen. And some cities are doing that. Like Chicago has a much better robust policy around GNT magnet school programs to make sure that they are more equitable. Are they entirely equitable? No. But anytime that there's something radical in education, people always start worrying about the white middle class leaving the city. That's the first thing that they worry about. I'm going to take this question from Elaine. Elaine asks, could you comment on your turn to looking at the school historically? Elaine's question just bounced around. One second. Instead of synchronously at leadership, what does the historical give us a view at a particular versus a particular point in time? So I think I'm going to steal my friend Jack Schneider's answer to this question, Elaine. Jack, at a talk that I did in November, pointed out that when we look at it historically, we can look at how hard the fight has to be for public schools. And so I think like in this moment where we're seeing public education under massive assault, teachers are under massive assault in terms of the rhetoric that's being spewed at them from, you know, debates around is critical race theory being taught in public schools to teachers are lazy and that's why they didn't want to teach during a global pandemic, neither which do I support in terms of rhetoric. But we see that this is a time in which public education is under real threat and dismantling. And we see the rise again of privatization. One of the things that Jack pointed out is that even though this can be a hard read, looking at it historically shows, number one, what Michael Katz always reminded me is that there always were alternatives that we did not take. So desegregation, we could have desegregated schools very easily when schools were not 80% Black, right? Like it would have been easier to do that. There were proposals to basically cut up the school district of Philadelphia and merge it with suburban districts. We could have done that. And suburban districts could have then allocated funding to the city of Philadelphia. It would have desegregated the suburbs. It would have desegregated the city. And lo and behold, kids would have had the resources that they needed. Again, we didn't do that in 1970. When Mark Shedd went to Congress and asked Congress to basically create a federal funding stream for the 25 lowest funded urban public school systems, the federal government could have done that, and they didn't. So I think thinking about the alternatives that were on the table that weren't taken is really important historically. But I also just thinking about how long schools have been underfunded shows us how hard this fight has to be and that our demands have to be high if we want to have democracy and public education survive. And if we want kids cared for in the ways that kids deserve to be cared for, regardless of who they are. And so I think that's really important historically. If I only looked at a snapshot, you would see this like miracle story that actually was built on a foundation that was super shaky. And so I think that's really important to think about and probably why I decided to become a historian. Oh yeah, let me point this out. Thanks, Alan. So the Wissahickon Boys Club, one of the things that I think is really important is the Wissahickon Boys Club was an all Black boys club. All of the boys clubs and YMCAs in Germantown were segregated by race and oftentimes by gender. So there was a Black YWCA, a Black YMCA, the Black Boys Club, which allowed girls to also participate in programs, although on a more limited basis. And that both afforded space for Black history, Black literature. William T. Coleman Sr., who was the first director of the Wissahickon Boys Club, also provided a movie space so that Black children didn't have to go to segregated movie theaters. So the kids came to the club and watched movies on Friday and Saturday nights, and they went to dances that were not segregated. Charles Shirley, who I interviewed for the book, told me that the boys club was his savior because his parents both worked day jobs and had to take whatever work was available to them. They could go to the boys club and they had free childcare anytime they wanted. So to think about that as a resource that I think gets largely overlooked, schools don't have those resources and neighborhoods don't have those resources as much anymore. And that would make a world of difference for anyone that has to work like I do, right? So like to think about childcare just being provided by people who are from your community, who care about your children, who know their names on the streets. William T. Coleman Sr. also implemented an approach to juvenile delinquency, which was much more restorative. He actually worked in tandem with police officers. And instead of having police officers arrest kids on the street, the police officers in Germantown would bring any member of the boys club to his house. And William T. Coleman Sr. would have a conversation with them. And then the arrest never happened. And so to think about the ways in which that was a protective measure against Black children being arrested in Germantown. And he received national accolades for that work. So again, it's extremely important. The one thing that also Alan pointed out is that Black residents had fewer resources because the YMCAs were oftentimes reliant completely on private philanthropy, and white philanthropists could raise more money because they had more wealth. And one of the things that was also really trying is when the YMCA forced integration, Black Germantowners who belonged to the Black YMCA did not really want to integrate their organization. They felt very committed to the racially segregated organization because they knew what integration would mean for them. They wouldn't be able to change necessarily the locker rooms. As many people reported at the Germantown Cricket Club, you could play tennis on the courts, but you couldn't change in the locker room. So to think about what that also means for kids. Thanks for that clarification. Andrew asked a question about the fact that there were only 9 Black students in Germantown High School in 1936 in a class of about 300 students. And why was that? What was the racial composition of Germantown? There were very few Black students at Germantown High School. Germantown High School was always a racially integrated high school, but in 1920, there were fewer than 10, and in 1930, there were fewer than 10. I don't know the stats for 1940. I'd have to look up in my book, but many of the high schools, Germantown just did not have many Black students attending the high school. There's an oral history in the book from Archibald Childs, who also worked at the All Black Wissahickon Boys Club. When his mother went to Germantown High School to register him for school, the guidance counselor told him that he was not allowed to take the academic track because he was Black. She didn't say that, but that was implied. And so his mother, who was a secondary school teacher, pulled him out of Germantown High School and sent him to a segregated school in the South so that he could receive the academic education that he received. In the book, I say, like, we don't know how many kids had Archibald's experience, but we know he did. And so the question is perhaps that parents were not willing to send their children to a racist institution, and they found other ways to provide educational opportunities for their kids in places where they could thrive. And I think that's really important to name. The other thing is that oftentimes students chose to go to Graz instead of Germantown, particularly in 1940s, because they had heard about the racism, or their family members had experienced racism inside Germantown High School. And so they chose to go to Graz, which had a higher percentage of Black students graduating from the school, rather than going to Germantown. So again, individual choices can create racial demographics as well as the racism of institutions inside of there. How important are fully, this is Barbara's question, how important are fully resourced school libraries with certified teacher librarians? Very important. I can't say enough about that. The fact that the School District of Philadelphia has so few librarians is a complete travesty for children and for families. Librarians also open worlds and windows to me as a teacher. I relied on them to help me with curriculum resources. And I also name in the book in my acknowledgments that the funding resources at the Free Library of Philadelphia, if you want to donate to a really great organization, that would be one I would put on my list. The Free Library of Philadelphia used to have librarians go out into city public schools and share their resources with families and communities. And so to think about both the decimation of librarians within the public schools that are funded with the school district, but also the cultural resources and institutions in the city that don't have the same funding streams that they used to have, is something we should all be thinking about. Ruth, I'm going to comment about this question. I talked about effective principals at Germantown. I think, and I say this as a teacher, effective principals really matter for teachers to be happy and thrive. They allow autonomous and free teaching to happen, and they provide resources that teachers need to teach well. When I had great administrators, my life was pretty wonderful. And when I didn't, which was pretty rare, it was not as easy. And can I comment about the school culture and the continued changing of principals at Germantown High School? So in the 1990s and early 2000s, Germantown High School had on average a new principal every other year. You can't sustain school culture or build capacity with teachers and trust and love and relationships with kids if you have a new principal basically every other year. It was a revolving door of principals. George Schuler was there for many years in the late 90s. George Schuler was an alum of the school. George Schuler said when he walked into the building, he could not believe it was his high school because of the changes in the school facilities. He was there the longest, but then after that, it was pretty much a revolving door of principals. And so again, teachers didn't trust the administrators that were coming into the building, and they really couldn't sustain the policies and practices that would help teachers and kids thrive. So it's incredibly important. Oh, here's Janelle's student. Let me answer this question. This will be my last question. This is from Samir. When you were on the journey of completing this project, did you have any reflections on your own educational experiences? And if so, what were some of those reflections? And also, hey, Mrs. Moore, love. I had a lot. And Akira knows this because I was like, I think I'm going to write this prologue at the last minute. I went to an under-resourced public school. And the people that made the difference in my life were my extracurricular teachers. So my cello teacher, Nancy Bond, my voice teacher, Joy Boynton. And my parents were able to provide me with those opportunities because they had the fiscal resources and time to do so. I thought a lot about that as a kid. And I thought a lot about my school guidance counselor, who I don't know why he thought I was worth believing in, but he did. And when I told him I wanted to go to Wellesley College from my little rural hometown, he called Wellesley College and found out what I needed to have on my transcript to make sure I could get in there. Now, did he know I was going to get in there? I don't think so, but he called and I got in. And I'm a first generation college student. And I think about that every day, the people who open up doors. And I think most importantly about my parents who opened every door to let me walk through and how hard they fought to be heard and seen in schools. And I think about that now as a mom of two wonderful children. I think about that as an educator at a place where first generation students should be seen and heard every single day. And I try my damn best to do so. And I think about that when I'm in Ms. Moore Allman's classroom and I see brilliant teachers doing that too. So I think about those kind of questions, right? I think I tell my students all the time that your experiences matter and they shape who you are as a researcher, and we shouldn't have to table our humanity just to be objective, because I'm not objective. I'm a whole person and I bring that whole humanity to my work and everything that I do. And sometimes I get in arguments and discussions with the people on this call and they make me a better person for it. So I see them all laughing. So they all know that. I want to thank Andy again for organizing this, Gigi for being amazing. And of course, I want to thank Akira, Janelle, and Ted for being here for so many years. And for everyone on this call for giving up part of your Thursday evening, I really appreciate it. And if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out. I am findable on a Google search. All right. Be well and be safe. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.